We want to give thanks to Lacey Brummel from the Episcopal Church, who has been so helpful in facilitating many of the logistics for today's PowerPoint presentation. And we want to remind everyone that she has placed us all on a mute. If you need to speak, then it will be necessary to press star 6. Lacey, can you hear me still now?
Yes, I can. I'm about to press everyone on mute, so you'll probably need to press star 6.
Great. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, so again, just to be sure everyone knows you're on a mute, anytime when our speakers are speaking, just press star 6 to unmute yourself. And during the final portion of the call, during questions and answers, we'll invite all of you who are listening to please consider putting forward your question. We also want to remind you that you can do that anytime during the presentation of the call by taking your cursor up to the top of the slide that you see on the screen. And as you do that, if you select the second box, there you'll see four green circles. If you select the second circle from the left, that's the chat function, and that will give you an opportunity to submit your question. You can do it that way, or again, at the end, we'll invite you to press star 6, and you can give it to us that way as well. So I want to very briefly introduce those who will be our presenters for today. We'll be beginning in just a moment with Kamal Esaheb from the National Immigration Law Center, who will help us look at the decision that was made, the tie vote that was the result thus far in the U.S. versus Texas case, and he will lead us into some conversations and a look at implications and next steps ahead for undocumented communities. Then we'll have the opportunity to hear a personal story from Arturo Hernandez Garcia, who has been in sanctuary himself, who has provided leadership and partnership with the Metro Denver Sanctuary Coalition, and who would have been a potential DAPA recipient had the president's actions been able to go forward and to be unfolded and moved into implementation. We're really grateful to have Arturo here with us today as well. In addition, we're joined by Ashley Feasley, a great colleague with the Interfaith Immigration Coalition, a partner and staff member at Clinic, who will be guiding us through looking at some of the anticipated federal, state, and local legislative attacks that we have seen coming upon the undocumented community and what is expected perhaps to lie ahead through the end of 2016. After that, we'll be encouraged by Megan Cagle with Church World Service, who will lead us into ways that we can communicate to protect our communities and to ensure that we're moving ahead towards making immigration a key issue in the 2016 elections as we move into the next couple of months ahead. And then following that, Noel Anderson, also with Church World Service as the grassroots coordinator, will help us really unwrap discussions related to faith organizing for a better future. How can we build local coalitions? How can we connect our partnerships with one another in order to ensure we're elevating issues related to immigrant rights and we hope immigration reform in 2016? And then we'll end with questions and answers. So at this point, we'll go forward to the next slide. And Kamal, we're going to turn the time over to you. Again, if you'll just press star 6 and others, please begin to form your questions. You may like to ask Kamal and other speakers. Again, you can put them into the chat function, second green circle at the top of the screen, or you can press star 6 at the end of the call to ask. Kamal, thank you so much for being with us. And we're not hearing you yet, so we think you may need to press star 6, and then we should be able to hear your voice. Are you there, Kamal? Unfortunately, we're still not hearing you. If you can, press star 6 on your phone, and that should unmute you. And Lacey, perhaps since that's not working, maybe we should have you take us all off of mute so that we can hear Kamal. Sorry, Kamal. Can you hear me now, Lacey?
I can hear you, yes. One second.
Okay. So I think everyone went back onto mute. It said unmuted, and then it said muted again. So
yes.
Maybe press. Okay.
Can you hear me now, Sharon?
Yes, we've got you now, and I think everyone is unmuted at this point. We'll give this a try. If we end up getting too much background noise, we may need to have Lacey put us all on unmute. But we'll turn it right over to you, Kamal.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Sharon, for that introduction, and thank you to the folks at the Interfaith Immigration Coalition for organizing this really important webinar. And for joining us to hear about all about these issues today. So we at the National Immigration Law Center, and really all our allies in the immigrant rights movement, are just now recovering from the disappointment of last month's non-decision at the Supreme Court. We knew, we mapped out all the possible legal scenarios, and we knew that 4-4 outcome was a strong possibility, but we're still confident that the law is on our side and we're hopeful that the Supreme Court would decide based on the rule of law and not based on politics. But unfortunately, the court's inability to reach a decision is a temporary setback to our movement. Although the immediate days after the decision or the non-decision felt like we were in mourning, let's remember that these programs, DACA Plus, and DAPA, really came about because of courageous and creative organizing by immigrant youth, parents, workers, and allies who all worked together to pressure this president to take action and create these initiatives. Next slide, please. So after the president's announcement of these programs in November 2012 and 2014, Texas and 25 other states challenged them. And then they handpicked a judge, a conservative district court judge in Brownsville, Texas, who had been very critical of this president's immigration policies. And not surprisingly, the judge sided with these states and issued a nationwide injunction blocking the federal government from moving forward with implementing these programs, DACA Plus and DAPA. That judge's decision was affirmed by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then that went up, ultimately, that the case went up to the Supreme Court. Next slide, please. And on June 23rd, so just about a month ago, the Supreme Court was not able to reach a decision and voted 4-4. Because of the vacant seat on the bench that Senate leadership have failed to fill, what normally is a 9-justice court was now 8 justices, we got a tie outcome. We got the non-decision that we got. And what this deadlock means is that the lower court's decision stands. So the district court's nationwide injunction remains in effect, which is very disappointing, even though this decision, this non-decision by the Supreme Court, sets no precedent. I'm hearing some sound in the background. Can folks still hear me?
Right, and let's encourage everyone, if you will, to put your personal phones on mute at your point of origin. That'll help.
So on various fronts, we have, what we have is really a political decision. We have a handpicked judge who is opposed to this president's immigration policy setting a nationwide injunction. And then we have a Senate that's opposed to the president that's refusing to appoint a ninth justice. And at the end of the day, we have a non-decision, and we have millions of immigrant families who really have yet to get their full day in court. Now, it's important to note that although this decision touches on the DACA expansion of November 2014, Texas and the other 25 states did not challenge the original 2012 DACA program. So the original DACA program is not directly impacted by this decision. Next slide, please. Next slide. So about a week ago Monday, the Department of Justice sought rehearing. Word on that line, rehearing before the full Supreme Court. Essentially, the U.S. government asked that until there is a ninth justice in the court, or when there is a ninth justice in the court, this Supreme Court should take up the case again and rehear arguments. Essentially, give the families who are impacted, a fair shot at a decision of the court. So it's not a quick solution. We don't know if the Supreme Court will agree to grant rehearing. It does this sometimes, particularly when there is a 4-4 split on an issue of national importance. But it is something that's not commonly granted by the Supreme Court. When the Supreme Court decides a case, it has an interest in and just being done with it. So we're hopeful, but we're not holding our breath. And even if the Supreme Court were to grant this rehearing, this isn't something that would lead to a positive decision in weeks or in months. We're probably looking at the spring of 2018 at the earliest in terms of getting a decision. Now, it's important to know that the case does move forward at the same time in district court. The case went up to the Supreme Court on something called a preliminary injunction, which means that before the judge got to see all the facts, that he ordered that the government stop implementing the program until a final decision can be made after a trial, after the parties exchange evidence, and so on. So none of those things have happened yet. So now there's an opportunity for the district court judge, who, again, is not very friendly to this case, to look at all the issues, all the matters that are implicated, to go to a full trial, so to speak. So those proceedings can continue, and we would expect that there would be a loss there, which could potentially itself send the case back to the Supreme Court. Again, not anytime soon. And I'll just, on the last bullet, let me just flag here that there is some thinking underway about ways to creatively either challenge the injunction or limit its scope. So some folks are doing some thinking about whether there might be opportunities there. But again, this is still very much in a lot of that thinking is still very much in the initial stages. Next slide, please. Actually, if you can go back one slide. Okay, thank you. So some implications of the decision that we need to be wary of. Obviously, we need to protect DACA 2012. It was not directly, it was not a part of the lawsuit that Texas and the 25 other states brought. So it was not enjoined, and the Supreme Court's non-decision does not relate to it. But obviously some of the same issues that are implicated in Texas's challenge also relate to the original DACA program. So we need to be very vigilant in protecting the program if and when there is a challenge. In fact, Chris Kobach, who is some see as one of the masterminds behind Texas's lawsuit, has already hinted that there may be a challenge on the original DACA program in the works. Obviously, this decision, this non-decision by the Supreme Court, it really increases the stakes for the November elections. At a minimum, the Supreme Court justice that would be appointed would be impacted by the outcome of the elections, and certainly the congressional makeup could affect how this next Congress addresses issues of interest to immigrants. And at the same time, and I know some of the speakers will speak directly to this, we need to continue advocating against the detention and the deportation system so that people can go about their lives feeling safe and living dignified existence. And of course, it goes without saying that immigrants and allies are going to just continue fighting to keep families and communities whole. Next slide, please. So I'll conclude with this. So Texas and the other states that challenged the DACA program, the DACA Plus and DAPA programs, did not challenge the enforcement priorities from November 2014, which are flawed and have not been implemented uniformly or effectively. But it's important to keep in mind that those priorities remain in effect. So what that means is DHS is not going to deport everybody who's undocumented tomorrow. It's not going to deport everybody who would have been eligible for DACA DAPA tomorrow. And in fact, what DHS, Department of Homeland Security, has said is they're only deporting people who are so-called high priorities for deportation. And the categories that you see there are the priority categories they've identified. We have a lot of issues with both the priority categories themselves and with the way they've been implemented. But I think it's important for people to know that these haven't changed and they're not affected by the U.S. v. Texas outcome from the Supreme Court. So let me stop there, and happy to answer any questions in the Q&A session.
Great. Thank you so much, Kamal. We really appreciate your time with us. We hope that folks, as you were listening to Kamal, were able to be thinking about questions you want to ask related to challenges to the injunction, protection of 2012 DACA, advocacy that is important to be doing as we move towards election time, enforcement priorities, all of those very important topics that Kamal touched on in his presentation. And at this time, before we move to our next speaker, who is Arturo Hernandez Garcia from the Metro Denver Sanctuary Coalition, and and someone who, as we've just heard, from the macro level, the significance of the Tide decision from June 23rd, we will now have a chance to learn from Arturo in a very personal way the impact that continues upon his life because of the programs not being able to go forward. And I wanted to see, first of all, do we have Arturo and Noel on the line? Arturo?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Then I think we'll go ahead with you and with Noel, and then after you two present, Ashley, before your time, we're going to attempt again to put folks back on a hard mute because we were hearing some other background noise and some typing in the background, but we'll let you two go ahead and present first, and then we'll try that before Ashley. Go ahead.
My name is Arturo Hernandez. I live in Denver for 16 years. I come from Mexico, Chihuahua, Mexico, and I'm married for 17 years. And I have two daughters. One 17. My daughter she has 17 years. She qualified for DACA, and she born in Mexico. And I have another daughter, she born here in Denver. Pastor, ¿me puede traducir?
Claro que sí.
Okay. Yo viví en Santuario por 9 meses para tratar de evitar mi deportación.
So I lived in Sanctuary for 9 months to stop my deportation order.
Y pues pudimos lograr parar la orden de deportación, pero no pude obtener ningún recurso legal, no pude obtener permiso ni ningún estatus legal, solo me dijeron que iban a parar mi orden de deportación por un tiempo, o no sé por cuánto tiempo, pero solo me dijeron que me iban a buscar para deportarme.
So we struggled to try to win a stay of removal while I was in sanctuary, and unfortunately we weren't able to completely get the stay. We were given assurance by ICE that I wouldn't be deported, but we still have no official legal remedy that will officially say that I won't be deported.
Y pues legalmente ya no tengo muchos recursos para poder obtener algo para seguir peleando mi caso, y pues una de las, o la última de las opciones casi, era esperar por DAPA, ¿no? Y pero al ser negado, no sé cuál va a ser mi situación ahora.
Right now it's very difficult in terms of resources for us to continue to pay for our lawyer and legal support, and we were very much hoping for DAPA. It was very much our sort of last resort, and we've been let down by not getting it through the Supreme Court.
Pues DAPA era una de las opciones para poder obtener algo legal, poder estar tranquilo con mi familia, pero pues ahora estamos a reunirnos con mi abogada y parece ser que la única opción es tratar de someter una petición para reabrir el caso.
So DAPA for us was the last resort, and we are hoping, you know, that we'd be able to finally live in peace without fear of deportation and have legal remedy. But unfortunately, instead, we're meeting with the lawyer again and going back and seeing if it's possible to reopen my case.
El problema, pues, no es que somos miles, no millones de personas que estamos en esta situación, que contábamos con con que el DACA pasara y que el DACA continúe también, ¿no?, para nuestros hijos, porque pues se vienen momentos difíciles y con las nuevas elecciones y llega a ganar el candidato republicano, nos vamos a estar en serios problemas, ¿no?, con peor de lo que estamos ahora.
The problem is that there's millions of people just like me that were hoping for this opportunity that DAPA would have given, and also for our children to be able to get DACA. And so it's a very difficult situation that we're in, and especially in this election cycle, we feel if the Republican candidate were to win, we would be in a much worse situation.
Bueno, y triste también porque dándome cuenta de que mucha gente sigue siendo deportada y pues a padres de familia siguen siendo deportados y quedan familias separadas, ¿no? Y triste continuar viendo esa situación y impotente no poder hacer nada y no tener nada a favor de nuestras familias, que no podamos hacer nada, eso es difícil.
And it's also sad because we keep on hearing of people being deported, fathers separated from their families. And after losing DAPA, there is a sense that we have lost our power. And so we are trying to figure out how to regain that.
Bueno, y eso es un poco de mi situación y... No sé, vamos a esperar y primero Dios tengamos alguna situación o alguna oportunidad para poder estar legalmente en este país. Gracias por escuchar mi historia y por invitarme a estar con ustedes.
Así es, Arturo. So we now we are still, you know, always looking to figure out, well, what can we do next and how can we be here in a legal way, and so that our families are safe, and we'll keep working towards that end. And I should just say as well that, you know, Arturo is planning, we're planning a sanctuary movement convening, and he's one of the leaders that's planning to attend in Phoenix, and so hopefully we can work together to build a new strategy together. So thank you so much, Arturo, for telling us your story, and I also know from knowing you that you will keep on fighting, so as all of us will along your side.
Thank you, and thank you, everybody.
Amen. Thank you again, Arturo. Thank you, Noel, for your partnership and interpretation. We honor you, Arturo, for the heartbreak that you have shared, for the courage that you have shown, and we join with you in seeking the vision for so many next steps to continue to seek to reestablish hope. At this time, we're going to try, Lacey, if you will, in a moment, put us all again on a mute, and then Ashley, if you and other speakers who follow you would press star 6, you should be able to be heard. So, Lacey, we'll give you a moment to do that. Can you hear me now, Lacey? Can you hear me? Hello?
We can hear you, Sharon.
Okay, perfect. All right, so we're going to move then now, Ashley, to you to guide us into types of negative legislation that we've seen, attacks that have happened, and ones that, sadly, we are anticipating we may see more of.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Wanted to say thank you so much for everybody here on the call and for the wonderful job that Kamal and Arturo have done in kind of setting up both the macro of USV Texas, where we are now, and also the personal experience of individuals who have been affected negatively by the Supreme Court's failure to get a decision. So I'm going to switch gears to talk a little bit about right now, after, you know, the review of the preliminary injunction in U.S. v. Texas, we're going to look at the national and local legislative attacks and also just look at some of what's happened relating to enforcement and maybe what we can see. And then what we'll be expecting and what we can do as, you know, we wind into the end of the year and the presidential election, both with the administration, with Congress, and with the state and local. And so I'm going to start first with the administration and looking at the enforcement priorities, the PEP program, and prosecutorial discretion. And then, so starting with that, Kamal did a very nice job and on his last slide of talking about the priorities for removal. And what exactly, where do we get these enforcement priorities? Well, in November 2014, one of the pieces of the executive action, in addition to expanded DACA and DAPA, was a changing of the Department of Homeland Security's enforcement priorities. And Kamal kind of gave you the three kind of buckets, the categories that the administration changed to the new way that they were going to look at who they need to remove and ultimately deport. And the piece of the policy guidance is a real mouthful, but it's the DHS policies for the apprehension, detention, removal of undocumented immigrants memo, which I refer to as the DHS priorities memo. So this was issued in November 2014, and it's about 5 to 6 pages. It gives the categories that Kamal talked about, and then it gives some other circumstances. In June of 2015, after many advocates have kind of pushed for more information, there were frequently asked questions relating to the executive action on immigration that were released on the ICE webpage, and I can share a link and people can go to it. Why did they release the frequently asked questions? Well, there were a lot of questions about how this memo was going to be implemented, how there certain pieces were interpreted. It replaced a former program, the Secure Communities Program, and there were just a lot of outstanding questions. And the program that replaced the Secure Communities Program is the PEP program, or the Priority Enforcement Program. So this PEP program builds on this memo that we're talking about here today. Both of these are pieces of the new DHS kind of enforcement regime that were part of the executive action, and they're still in existence. So they have not been affected by U.S. v. Texas. They continue to be the law of the land for how the Department of Homeland Security is identifying people that they want to be targets for removal and how they're making some of those decisions. Now, Kamal spoke a little bit about these three categories, but there's another piece to this that really is important as we look at the implementation of this and as we look at how to help families and individuals, you know, in the wake of the U.S. v. Texas decision, and that is prosecutorial discretion. If you could go to the next slide. So first off, what is prosecutorial discretion? Generally, prosecutorial discretion is the authority exercised by every law enforcement agency to set their own priorities and decide how to pursue a particular case based on their priorities. So it's basically the government's right, in this case DHS's right, to decide those three categories that Kamal was talking about and how ICE officers are going to kind of implement them. Now, what's the connection here? The memo that I'm talking about, it directs personnel to review every case for prosecutorial discretion, provided it has certain guidelines. And so if you look at page 2, we see that all personnel are supposed to exercise discretion in as early as possible of the proceedings as they can. And then another important element to remember is people who do not fall within any of these priority categories are not to be removed unless removal would serve an important federal interest. Now, much has been debated about the prosecutorial discretion clauses within the memo and how they're being implemented. And it's really important, I think, to note that despite several mentions of prosecutorial discretion in the DHS priorities memo and an additional frequently asked questions that's been released, there's no strict definition that's given as to what exactly the Department of Homeland Security means by prosecutorial discretion. And so when we think about the administration, it's really important, if you could turn to the next slide, it's really important for us to think about what exactly we can do now to help individuals as it comes to the administration working on the existing pieces of the executive action, like the memo, the PEP program, and prosecutorial discretion. In terms of the PEP program, we as advocates and individuals in the community, we need to seek more clarity on PEP implementation from field offices and then also from headquarters level. We need data as to how are these programs being implemented in our communities and what does that look like. Conversely, in addition to asking for increased data about what, you know, implementation is looking like, we need to work to educate local lawmakers about the effects of PEP on the community. This is the time to bring forth stories about, you know, programs maybe having undesired and unforeseen consequences, the importance to kind of lift up the voices of law enforcement officers and those in the affected community who maybe have had an experience with PEP that, you know, maybe was not at all what the lawmaker had envisioned when they agreed to work with DHS. The second basket, I would say, is the importance of thinking about prosecutorial discretion and how we can lift that up. Kamal mentioned a little bit about that there's been some problems on how we're implementing, how we're seeing DHS implement some of these priorities. We must continue to push the administration to use the prosecutorial discretion. We have to continue to bring cases to the ICE field office at the local level and then be willing to elevate to the Department of Homeland Security in the event that the cases are not fully vetted and examined, you know, with the full extent of evaluating through prosecutorial discretion lens. We also need to push the Department of Homeland Security to be more transparent about what is prosecutorial discretion here and how are you applying it. These things can be done now, and they really are about kind of listening to communities and listening to stories of individuals who maybe have not received their full due process rights or maybe have not received a full evaluation according to prosecutorial discretion. And we can all kind of continue to do that in the wake of USB Texas and continue to press the administration to consistently implement this piece of the executive action. So now I'm going to turn to the federal level. It's been a doozy on the federal level in relation to what we're seeing for anti-sanctuary cities and anti-immigrant enforcement. Many of you know about S-2193, which was known as Cates Law or the Stop Illegal Reentry Act. This was a bill that was introduced by Senator Ted Cruz. The bill was introduced quite a while ago in 2015, but recently was given cloture to proceed in July, and the Senate actually voted down and it did not move forward. But it basically would have amended the INA to increase from 2 to 5 years the maximum term for an undocumented individual who reenters after being denied admission, excluded, deported, or removed. Supposedly, this bill was in response to the Kate Steinle tragedy, but I would say, given the timing, it's a little bit seeking to capitalize on some of the anti-immigrant sentiment going on. A similarly political-motivated bill was S-3100, the Stop Dangerous Sanctuary Cities Act. This bill was introduced by Senator Toomey of Pennsylvania. This is a bill that sought to restrict funding for certain sanctuary cities, municipalities, and has been openly acknowledged to be something that was kind of in consideration because Senator Toomey is facing a rather difficult reelection campaign, and he wanted to appear tough on immigration and tough on crime. So the vote went forth but was not picked up ultimately. I put H.R. 5654 because it's the companion bill to S3100. It was introduced by Representative Black. It's an identical bill in the House, and this is a bill that could see some movement in the coming weeks. But I really want to focus for a minute on the appropriations process. So when the Congress is currently on a recess and they're going to come back on September 5th, when they come back on September 5th, they have roughly 19 days to kind of get through to the end of the fiscal year all of the existing appropriations matters that are there. And I think that it's a possibility that as the individual appropriation bills and the possibility of an omnibus or a continuing resolution are being negotiated, we could see some anti-sanctuary city or anti-immigrant bills or rider language put in or amendments. So it is something to flag and think about in the future. I'm going to go quickly to the state, more kind of discussion as to what we're seeing on the state and local level. So the number of anti-sanctuary and enforcement bills we saw for the first part of the legislative calendar for state and local this year was over 50. It's important to note that we only have 9 states and D.C. Still in session, but we have a couple states that, again, have a lot of kind of political action going on that have bills relating to sanctuary cities that still will be present. One of such is Pennsylvania, and that bill is HB 1885. We haven't seen any motion on this bill, but we could likely see it as some of the candidates move forward with their reelection. So if we could go to the last slide. So I've thrown a lot of information at you on the federal and state, but I think that this is an area where we really can move forward and need to provide a unified front because there may be some attacks coming up and leading into the presidential election. So I think it's really key to understand the 2016 election connection here when we're talking about Congress and also your state and local lawmakers. Everyone knows that 2016 is a presidential election year, but there's congressional and gubernatorial races that are really kind of driving some of what we're seeing on the anti-immigrant, and particularly in immigration enforcement issues. Currently for the Senate, we have 34 seats that are going to be up for re-election. 24 are Republican-held seats. And it's significant because many of these are candidates are running for re-election and will likely be facing very conservative opponents in their primaries. And, you know, we actually did see, you know, with Senator Toomey, as I mentioned, kind of a bill that was given up as a token. Similarly, in the House of Representatives, we have 41 representatives who are not seeking re-election, and 25 of them are Republican. Many of them are running for Senate themselves, or they, you know, are making decisions about not to run. And lastly, on the gubernatorial, we have 12 races, a couple of which we've seen some anti-refugee and anti-immigrant bills, South Dakota, North Carolina, and Indiana. Why does this matter? Well, it's really important to remember that your local lawmakers, whether they're your U.S. representatives, your U.S. senators, or your state representatives, they are feeling the election heat, and immigration is a big issue. And they're going to make decisions kind of based on where they are in their elections. And so this is why leading into the second point about giving face time to lawmakers is vital. I think particularly on the state and local level, many of the lawmakers who are introducing some of the particularly pernicious immigrant enforcement bills, they don't really know a whole lot about immigration enforcement. They are maybe put into a situation where they need it for reelection purposes or their base purposes. And so we really should take the opportunity to continue to educate our lawmakers about immigration enforcement and really signal that the importance of this issue and the immigration issue generally to voters. And I think this leads to the last and the most important point. part of that education process is making sure that many diverse individuals continue to have a seat at the table when it comes to talking about these immigration enforcement issues in these coming months. Individuals like Arturo, who can speak about what has happened in their community while they were waiting for DACA DAPA, the contributions that they make, the fact that there's a need for larger reform and that immigrant enforcement, you know, that as it's going now, is destructive to communities. Law enforcement officers, local individuals who maybe understand that federal immigration enforcement officers coming into their local community really disrupts a trust-building exercise of local law enforcement officers and goes against general principles of subsidiarity. And lastly, faith leaders who frequently are sometimes go-betweens on some of these, you know, community-building exercises. All of these individuals really need to be on deck in the next, you know, 4 to 5 months to push back at the local level whatever negative pieces of legislation that we're going to see. I'm really thankful for the opportunity to talk to you guys, and I'm happy to answer questions afterwards.
Thanks, Ashley. And as we get ready to transition from you, we did already, if you could just quickly cover, we had a speaker ask if you could repeat quickly the number of Senate seats and House seats that are up for election in this current session coming up.
Sure. For Senate, there's 34 seats and 24 Republican-held seats. And for the House, we have 41 representatives who are not seeking reelection. So I don't know how many total, but it's 25 of those individuals happen to be Republicans. So we're seeing a new round of primaries and decision-making. Some of those individuals are people who are looking to run for the Senate seat that's being vacated. But that's, and then for the governors, we have 12 different races.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much. And we're going to move now quickly to Megan. I know our time is moving forward, but Megan, please help us as faith communities know what to keep in mind as we're hopefully lifting our voices, as Ashley has encouraged us to do, to legislators and to the media. And you will have to press star 6 for us to hear you.
Great. Thank you. Can you all hear me?
Perfect, yes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all so much for joining us today and for everyone who's already presented. As you all have heard, there's a lot to keep in mind moving forward. Given the Supreme Court's split decision and the upcoming election, there are quite a few messages that we need to keep in mind moving forward so that we can have a united voice and really push forward the changes that we want to see. As you can see on the slide, if you're following along online, we really want to emphasize three particular messages. The first is that the original DACA program is still in effect and people can apply. I know there's been some confusion and some fear perhaps that the original DACA program has been impacted, but we do want to let people know that people can still apply. The second message is that especially as faith communities and just as advocates, we will continue to stand with our immigrant brothers and sisters as we fight for immigration reform policies that keep families and communities united, but also treat everyone with the respect and dignity that they deserve. We want to make sure that we're emphasizing the real human cost of our broken and outdated immigration policies. The third message is that cases like DAPA and expanded DACA are too critical to be heard without a full court. Kamal really drove this point home in that we need a full Supreme Court with 9 justices because, like we've seen, unfortunately, in DAPA and expanded DACA, we can have these split decisions that really have such a huge impact on people's lives. So we must push for a full court. And I know there's been some incredible resources that have been distributed. We can share those as well on the IIC website, along with the recording of this call and the slides. But they provide some additional resources for faith communities specifically to continue to push out this message that we need 9 Supreme Court justices. If we can go to the next slide, please. So now that we have the messages, how are we going to share these messages? And really the most powerful way to put forth these messages, not only into the media, but into our communities as a whole, is through sharing our own stories. Stories are the most powerful way that we can communicate and connect with people at not just an ideological level, but at an emotional level. If we communicate the fact that families are being separated and torn apart because of our nation's immigration policies, people can understand that maybe not at a political level, but they get that at an emotional level. So we as people of faith and as advocates with our immigrant brothers and sisters really need to drive this point home that this isn't about politics, but it's about families, and we need to share our personal stories and the stories of those within our communities to really drive these messages home. You can see on the slide there are some great ways to incorporate this storytelling through social media as well as in traditional media, even just simple graphics, sharing a link and a short snippet of a story with someone's face. It helps people put a face to the story, and it really helps drive home that emotional connection. If we can go to the next slide, please. Thank you. As I said, using both social and traditional media is really crucial to making sure that these messages reach the widest possible audience. Certainly, traditional media is great in really having a huge reach, but social media is also a great way to connect with your friends and your family and your community members that you see at on a day-to-day level but might not have these conversations about these kinds of important issues. You can use hashtags that are already in existence. For instance, the Fight for Families, DACA, DAPA, and We Need Nine. These are all really commonly used hashtags around this movement, and I would so encourage everyone to share their story and to share all of the work that you all are doing around this issue with these hashtags so that you can join the conversation online. You can also use traditional media to invite members of the press to any vigils, rallies, or other events that you have. You can also write letters to the editor and opinion articles. We had a great webinar a few months back about how you can write a successful op-ed and letter to the editor, and I encourage you to not only check out the recording of this PowerPoint, but the one before so that you can see some of those best practices, especially leading up to the election. I love how Ashley said the election connection. That's definitely something we want to drive home and make sure that people, not only at the presidential level, but candidates all the way from the presidency down to city council and school boards know that this is an issue we care about. Writing op-eds around the debates, they're coming up in September and then into October. It's something that the media will pay attention to and is a perfect time to use your voice to share your story and your community story. So I encourage everyone to find a way to use their stories in a way that maybe haven't been told in the media before, and we're here to help. I know that there's maybe some questions about this. There's been a lot of information that's presented today, and we can certainly answer questions after this, but feel free to reach out to any of us. We're happy to help share your stories, and thank you all so much for the work that you do and for sharing your stories so that we can really create the change we want to see.
Perfect. Thank you, Megan, so much. And we want to invite you again, as you have questions related to the speakers you've heard so far, to take your cursor up to the top of the screen above the slide, and the second green circle is the chat function, and you can click on that and just type your question in. And Megan, you moved us so beautifully as you talked about raising up voices to Noel's presentation next, and Noel, we'll turn it over to you to charge us to organize, to mobilize, to advocate, and to develop voters in the months ahead.
Great. Thank you so much, Sharon. Definitely we're going to want to be mobilizing people around everything that's been talked about today, the federal immigration attacks on immigrants, as well as the state level. We fended off bad bills against refugees and immigrants all year and have done really remarkably well stopping them. And now let's talk a little bit about where we are after the SCOTUS decision. We know that it was a devastating loss for our community, but we've been hearing you know, throughout the field that those who are most impacted are most willing to keep fighting for these reforms that will present, you know, more rights for their community, for their family. And we have a duty, of course, as allies, many of us, to people of faith, to be in solidarity and to walk along their side. Next slide, please. And so with that, there are several things to be thinking about. One is, you know, many groups have, many immigrants' rights groups as well as ally groups, have called for a moratorium on deportations, saying let's stop deportations altogether. President Obama could do that if he so chose to. You can find more information at the petition, at this link, at the Groundswell Movement site. And then also really what actually hit on is how can we stop deportations one case at a time. The Sanctuary Movement is one of those efforts, but we see cases popping up all over. You know, how can we advocate for these cases, keeping these families together? And some of these cases also have our people with past criminal convictions, whether it be a DUI or shoplifting or what have you. And I think the faith community's role in saying, well, you know, we believe in personal transformation, we believe in forgiveness, that people can change, and we are a community that gives people those second chances. Well, that goes a long way, and we've actually got an organizational sign-on letter that's going to be coming out soon about that, highlights a number of cases about those who have some kind of criminal convictions, and we really want to push the envelope, next slide, please, to stop this, you know, good versus bad immigrant. And another way in which we are doing this is with pushing back against enforcement. Some of you maybe remember the 1996 immigration reform, IRA, that really in a lot of ways hurt us. And that's when we saw mandatory detention come in, or the 3 to 10 year bar that, you know, if you've been in the country longer than a year and you're undocumented and you're married to a citizen, you're supposed to go back for 10 years to your home country before you can come back illegally. So, you know, can we get increased waivers or get rid of the 3 and 10 year bar altogether? Can we get rid of aggravated felonies that people with very minor criminal convictions, all of a sudden they're aggravated felonies just because of their immigration status? And there is, if you go to this website, you'll see that there is a whole concentrated effort to try to fix those bad problems with our immigration system. Now you can go to the next slide. And also, how can we be in solidarity and understand that immigrant rights is also a racial justice? It's not just about citizenship, and how racial profiling really impacts all people of color. And to really study up, you know, go to these websites of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Showing Up for Racial Justice, or Campaign Zero, which is really the policy platform for Black Lives Matters, and really think about how the immigration movement can also be in solidarity with the Black Lives Matters movement and stopping police violence. Next slide, please. And, of course, we've all, I think, mentioned already on this call the importance of voter mobilization, education, voter registration. Next slide. And we've had webinars about this before, so I won't go too into it, but we want to make sure that we're also helping mobilize the immigrant, the naturalized, of course, naturalized immigrant vote, those who have become citizens, help them get registered, help them know the ins and outs of our voting system, help them get to the polls. Next slide. And really get people out to vote. So how can we also help with early voting, you know, with congregations? We often call that schools to the polls. How can we be part of calling people through phone banking and making sure that they know where their polling precinct is and making sure that they're ready to vote, knocking on doors with door hangers, helping with carpool? These are the things that are going to be imperative as we get closer and closer to the election. Very likely the turnout of the vote may very much determine who wins. So next slide, please. So here are some toolkits that we passed on to you all before, but I wanted to make sure you had it, of all the different civic engagement toolkits that are out there and different organizations that we partner with that do the voter registration work. And that's about it for me. Next slide. Oh, and as we think about what a potential immigration reform could be like, assuming that we have a candidate in office that would support immigration reform, we need to press our candidates to really get the best possible immigration reform, to increase the voice of impacted leaders, to stop this, you know, felons, not families narrative, and to build a strong enough movement that we don't bargain away parts of our community for immigration reform like what happened in 2013 with things like E-Verify, losing the diversity visa, seeing huge border militarization. So really trying to get the best, most progressive platform on immigration that we can build in the potential transition as we look towards 2017.
Great. Thanks, Noel. And we'll go to the next slide as well, because we want to make sure that we highlight some particular resources for you. Each of these has a wealth of resources. The Sanctuary2014.org site is one where you can learn a lot about each of the individual cases around the country that are sanctuary cases, and also hear of some that have been successfully settled during the time that folks have been in sanctuary. Our basicinterfaithimmigration.org website has a host of resources related to a variety of both immigrant rights and refugee rights, appropriation processes, multiple alerts that are current. So please go to that site often. Other sites that are important to communicate with immigrant families related to knowledge of their rights and when to not open the door to ICE. And also, please, for legal assistance, go to the Fight for Families Help, especially the NILC site. The adminrelief.org is one where you can find an enormous amount of information about DACA, DACA Plus, DAPA, how to train community navigators, where to find local networks of immigrant rights advocates that you can hook up with all around the country, the iAmerica site, and then at the bottom is a resource that we have recently developed called Families Seeking Freedom that we developed through the Interfaith Immigration Coalition to help really lay out what happened in the split vote that came down from the Supreme Court, the heartbreak that it has caused, and to call faith communities into being a part of the healing and to actively engage to support families that have been at risk. We want to move now. I know we're at the top of the hour, but we want to have a few minutes for discussion and for questions. We do already have a particular question on the line, and I would direct it to any of our speakers who would like to respond. The question is recognizing the story that Donald Trump has been lifting up, a story from Iowa where, sadly, a drunk driver who was undocumented killed a valedictorian. We have heard that Donald Trump is using that as a kind of iconic story to sadly build additional venom against undocumented communities. Would someone like to respond about some good ways to speak back to that particular case as we may hear it mentioned?
This is Megan. I'm happy to answer the question, and if anyone else would like to jump in, then please go right on ahead. But I would certainly start out by obviously recognizing just the tragedy of the case. It's heartbreaking that the individual lost her life, and certainly sending out condolences to her family and friends and community. It's a tragedy, and acknowledging that, but also reminding people that the actions of one individual do not represent the actions of an entire community, and that an entire community should not be punished and held accountable for the actions of that individual. We wouldn't do that if within the broader community, we don't hold an entire community accountable for the actions of one individual. And so we just need to remind folks of that in this case as well.
And are there other questions that folks would like to ask? If you do, I remind you to either put it into the chat box or to press *6, and then we will all be able to hear your voice. I invite any further questions now related to the wide variety of issues of moving forward after last month's Supreme Court decision that we've been discussing today. All right, and we'll go to the final slide, which lists a number of resource partners through the multiple 52 and counting faith communities that are a part of the Interfaith Immigration Coalition Network. If you are a part of a particular faith community or denomination, you can see your representative, we hope, represented there on that slide. And we will look forward to ongoing communication with each of you. Know that we will be sending out the recording from today's webinar as soon as possible over the next day or two. We also will be posting it on the interfaithimmigration.org website along with all of the other webinars, and several of which you have heard referred to today with additional resources. Again, we want to thank Kamal, Arturo, Noel, Ashley, Megan, and myself, Reverend Sharon Stanley Ray, from Disciples of Christ. We thank you for the opportunity of being with you, and I wish to thank each of our other speakers, as well as all of you who have donated your time to be a part of our conversations today. We pray with you and for you as you continue to move forward in the weeks ahead, very important weeks, to lift up the needs and the hopes of our immigrant community brothers and sisters. Thank you again so much, and blessings to you. Bye-bye.